All right. My name is Tim Guile, one of the guiding teachers here, Seattle Insight. And tonight we'll do about a 40-minute meditation, just a little bit of guidance. And so hopefully you've had some training meditation. Otherwise, you can, you know, just practice along. And then I'll take a little break, and then we'll have a chance to do a talk on metta, which is the theme for this month. A poem called Clearing by Martha Postlewaite. Do not try to save the whole world or do anything grandiose. Instead, create a clearing in the dense forest of your life and wait there patiently until the song that is your life falls into your own cupped hands and you recognize and greet it. Only then will you know how to give yourself to this world so worth a rescue. So if you're new, visiting us for the first time, we typically have a year-long teaching theme. This year is around the perfections or the paramis. So these are 10 kind of qualities that the Buddha used to develop to really become awakened. And so here we use those as a time to really engage with our lives and our practice. Because sometimes our meditation practice can feel a little bit separate from the rest of our lives. Paramis are a great way to integrate those qualities. And this month, this is actually the ninth month, and we're exploring our ninth parami. We're focusing on loving kindness, or metta. Next month will be equanimity. So loving kindness is a really profound topic. There's lots of things we can explore around it. And tonight I want to explore a particular sutta called the Simile of the Saw. Right, so we'll kind of work into that one. It's a very dramatic, exciting sutta, really. But to connect with last week's, or 2 weeks ago, my talk was using metta as an antidote to fear and also to anger and how to bring that forth. And that's actually the Metta Sutta was originally designed by the Buddha to help some monks who are really scared of meditating in a kind of a haunted grove of trees. And so it's when we're feeling that sense of fear, that sense of anxiety, anger, that whole spectrum, we can call forth metta as a way to help us connect with this moment, to actually land into this quality of connection, quality of relationship with experience, this turning toward things versus pushing it away. That's so, you know, kind of built into anger and fear. It's a different way of relating. Helps us also establish a different intention around those qualities. Helps us slow down or interrupt the kind of stream of thoughts and emotions and actions by bringing in metta. It really creates some breathing room, some quality of being able to be present, allow us to regain some sense of balance. This is in some ways calling forth our wisdom, calling forth our compassion. So in the midst of a struggle, it's easy to get into that, you know, that hate or into that greed or that fear, but it calls forth this greater quality. It's like calling forth that metta quality. And ideally, this starts to shift our core intentionality, how we relate and connect with others, with ourselves and with other experiences, shifting it from greed and hatred and delusion to generosity, to non-harm, to kindness. So that's kind of last week's talk, the way we approached it. And tonight I want to kind of look at something that is kind of, I think, is easy to kind of creep into our practice if we're not aware of it. Because most of us are a little bit maybe achievement-oriented and kind of image-focused, and we kind of like the idea of being a kind person. I want people to see myself as a kind person. And it's a subtle distortion can come from that because we may value that kindness, we may value that quality, be generous, and start to adopt that as a persona, even though we may not actually feel that inside. You know, we may try to pretend like we are, kind of the fake it until we make it kind of philosophy. We start to become attached to this image of being a kind person. And then when we do that, it's a good question is what do we do with, you know, the very real experiences and feelings of anger, and fear. You know, what happens to those when we're trying to present ourselves as a kind person? There's, there's that saying that if the facts don't fit the theory, throw out the theory. You know, instead of using a chance to re-examine the theory, it's like, okay, I want to kind of ignore everything or repress everything that doesn't fit that. So if we repress, denial, or ignore those feelings and reactions that don't fit this image, what happens to that? You know, what happens? And often we can get away with that for a while until life gives us a certain test that something comes forth or a situation gets to the point we kind of let it all out. So this is in some ways a way of describing spiritual bypassing. This, I forget who coined this phrase, but we're basically kind of jumping over this humanness, this human feelings, to try to present ourselves as being, you know, a kind, loving person, even though deep down we're kind of really pissed off about something. So the Buddha had this sutta that he gave around this topic. It was called the Simile of the Saw. So he comes from the basket of suttas called the Middle Length Discourses of the Majjhima Nikaya, number 21. So online, I put that in the chat, actually, for you as a special bonus as well as the homework. So you should be able to find that. And maybe we could repost that in case someone came in a little bit after the break. So this story, this sutta, has actually some really dramatic elements, some very beautiful elements. It's one of my favorite suttas around the topic of loving kindness. So it starts off with, there's this lady of a household name, I'm going to mangle the Pali here, Vedahika, right? So there's a good report about this woman that has circulated, that she is gentle, she is even-tempered, she is calm. Now she had a servant named Kali who was diligent, deaf, and neat in her work. And the thought occurred to Kali, this servant, that this good report about my lady has circulated, that she's even-tempered, she's kind, she's considerate. Now, is anger actually present in my lady without it showing? Or is it absent? You know, has she really integrated this kindness? Or is there maybe some shadowing or some suppression of this? Or is it just because my work is neat that the anger present in my lady doesn't show? And for some reason, she decided to test it, to see what's really happening here. So she got up late after daybreak. So the lady got upset and said, "Hey, Kali, yes, ma'am, why did you get up after daybreak?" "No reason, no reason." "So no reason, you wicked servant, and yet you get up after daybreak." Angered and displeased, she scowled, right? So, all right, Kali's saying, okay, anger is present in my lady without showing, and it's not absent. It's not just because my work is neat that the anger is present. My lady doesn't show. Oh, it's just because it's pleasant. So things are going well. You know, the anger is not going to show up. For some reason, she decides to test her some more. So she got up even later the next day. So lady got even more upset. And then finally, the third time, as all of these things happen in thirds, Kali got up even later. And this time she got so mad she actually took a rolling pin and gave her a whack over the head, cutting it open. Then Kali, the servant, with blood streaming down her cut open head, went out and denounced her mistress to the neighbors. "See, ladies, the gentle one's handiwork." So showing all the blood. "See the even-tempered one's handiwork. See the calm one's handiwork. How could she, angered and displeased with her only servant for getting up after daybreak, grab hold of a rolling pin and give her a whack over the head, cutting it open?" So at that point, everybody changed their perception. Right? So this is an example of this kind of spiritual bypassing. So this mistress was wanting to present herself as this kind person, this gentle person. But there's this, that was as long as things were going her way. Everyone was agreeing with her. Her servant was doing what she wanted her to do. Didn't really elicit that. And this is a good thing to notice for ourselves, because at that point when life gives us those frictions, those rubs, I assume people do have some rubs in their life. Things aren't always perfect. You know, there's difficulties that arise. That's a point of practice. It's a chance to really pay attention and notice what's arising in this moment. I think that's such a beautiful thing to train yourself, is when you find yourself struggling, make that a point of being mindful, like a mindfulness bell calling you forth. What's actually happening in this heart, in this mind? What's actually here? And it's so important to do that, because our actions, if they're not conscious, tend to flow from anger or from fear. And those have consequences, right? We can talk about the karmic consequences, but just there's the very obvious consequences that people get upset. We hurt people. So this sutta, this story that the Buddha, he was telling a group of monks at the wherever they were staying, because I think this was kind of happening for these monks. They're trying to present themselves as being very calm, very centered, very together, right? But he said, okay, well, if things aren't going so well, what happens? You know, if you're not getting your food, if you're not getting your shelter, if someone criticizes you, you know what? That's really the test shows up. The test of being willing to, okay, see what happens in that moment. What's really our true default? What's our true refuge? And those of you who've been practicing for a while, you start to notice that that default starts to change. That there's times you would have been triggered and reactive. Actually, something comes up differently. This is the fruition of our practice. And it's a way of metta and action starting to flow forth, starting to engage in the way we are. So in this sutta, the Buddha goes through different types of speech in terms of, you know, what can happen, right? So it could be someone might address you that's timely or untimely, true or false, affectionate or harsh, beneficial or unbeneficial, with a mind of goodwill or with inner hate, right? So this is different ways people speak to you, communicate with you. So what the Buddha says here is that in any event, however someone speaks to you, whether it's kind or is harsh, beneficial or unbeneficial, with goodwill or inner hate, in any event, you should train yourselves. Our minds will be unaffected and we will say no evil words. We'll remain sympathetic to that person's welfare with a mind of goodwill and with no inner hate. We'll keep pervading toward them with an awareness imbued with goodwill, and beginning with them, we'll keep pervading the all-encompassing world with an awareness imbued with goodwill, abundant, expansive, immeasurable, free from hostility, free from ill will. That is how you should train yourselves. So the Buddha is basically saying, offering this quality of metta, regardless of how people treat you. Right? So how do we do that? Right? Denial doesn't seem to work, as that previous story said. You know, we're going to pretend we're happy until we just lose it and then we whack someone over the head with a rolling pin. Right? So then, but how do we bring forth this quality? So luckily the Buddha didn't just leave us with this instructions. He went into, this is one of the beautiful parts of this sutta. He brings forth really the wisdom of nature. How do you learn from nature? How to use nature as a guide in relationship to this. And he has about four different examples. So just go into the first one here. Suppose that a person were to come along carrying a hoe and a basket and saying, I will make the great earth be without earth. Okay, I'm going to get rid of the earth. You would dig here and there, scatter soil here and there, spit here and there, urinate here and there, saying, be without earth, be without earth. Now, what do you think? Would he make this great earth be without earth? Right? So you can picture this kind of ridiculous scenario. You're trying to dig up the earth and get rid of it, but yet there's so much earth, so much vastness around that. No. Why is that? Because this great earth is deep and enormous. It can't easily be made to be without earth. the person would reap only a share of weariness and disappointment. So what the Buddha says is using this analogy of just like if someone was insulting us or teasing us or irritating us, you know, try calling forth the vastness of the earth, how the earth is unaffected by those actions. There's such a vastness to it. There's such an immensity to it. So in any event, our minds, any event of whatever comes toward you, our minds will be unaffected and will say no evil words. We'll remain sympathetic to that person's welfare with a mind of goodwill and with no inner hate. We'll keep pervading toward them with an awareness imbued with goodwill and beginning with them. We'll keep pervading the all-compassing world with an awareness imbued with goodwill equal to the great earth. Equal to the great earth, abundant, expansive, immeasurable, free from hostility, free from ill will. All right, so this, he goes through a few more examples that we might get to if we have a chance. But if you start to see what he's pointing to is really, we try to do it from this, it's almost like a koan or a riddle, a spiritual riddle that we have to solve, that we have these human reactions that come up. Right, someone says something we don't like the outcome of some situation, and we get reactive to it. We lash out. Sometimes it feels very righteous. Sometimes we're trying to assert ourselves, trying to have a sense of boundaries around things. And so if we do this, if we feel that sense of reaction, if we act from it, it seems to cause more trouble, right? It only stirs us up, but also hurts other people. And there's that, the hurt comes back at us. If we try to deny it and repress it, that doesn't seem to work either, right? Because it just kind of gets buried and it kind of bubbles up in a more sideways manner. So what's the option? Seems like we're kind of, you know, what's the song? If I stay, there would be trouble. If I go, there would be double. Or, it's like there's not an easy way out. So what the Buddha's pointing here is this different way of relating to the whole issue. And this actually goes in a very deep way of practice. And he's kind of, the beauty of this is he's not talking about it so directly, but he's saying, use these metaphors of the earth, the sky, the river, to help you learn how to have this quality of emptiness, this quality of identification. When that falls away, then loving kindness is what's left, right? When that identification is there, that's when it's easy to become reactive. And this is tricky, right? Because it's so easy to do this spiritual bypassing. I want to get over this kind of selfish part of me, or this part of me that's filled with anger or with rage, and be a nice, shiny, you know, Buddha-like kind of person, right? But that doesn't work. So the way this starts to, way we can frame it, is that when we get angry or upset or irritated, all the different spectrums of that, our sense of who we are gets more narrow. It gets more contracted. It gets more defined, right? Think about the last time you're angry or irritated. Was there any unclarity about who you were and where you're located or who's having this emotion? There's a sense of, I'm upset. I'm scared. It's like it's that sense of you is so strong and so kind of solidified. I'm having this emotion. I'm feeling mad, feeling scared. This sense of me becomes really defined. So one way to work with this is to kind of expand that sense of self, that sense of container of what's actually holding this. I think this is, so again, we're getting kind of deep here, but that sense of self, that sense of who we take ourselves to be is one of those basic three characteristics of illusion that we tend to see. We see dukkha, we think seeing things as permanent when they're not, or dukkha, suffering when there's actually, we think it's pleasure, but it's actually suffering. We see something permanent when it's actually impermanent. We see a lasting sense of self when it's not really there. Now, for perhaps many of us, we start to hear that teaching and it doesn't really make sense, because what do you mean non-self? What do we mean that loss of perception or perspective, that narrowness of self? And yet that's really what the Buddha was teaching. He was teaching that sense of self is so tied to the suffering that you experience. The more you identified about with something, the more you attach to it, the more suffering that's going to be. Right? So we can be caring for something. We can be connected to something, but not attached to it. So it's not about becoming aloof and just disenchanted and disconnected from things. It's about learning where is that attachment. And it comes so much to this sense of who, that sense of I, that sense of me, that sense of mine. And as we start to hold that, okay, what if I let go of that, if that's not here, who's running the show? It's almost like everything vanishes, is what our minds project. What I like about this sutta is one way to look at that, is because that's scary. There's a sense of fear that comes up if we let go of that sense of self so fully, so deeply. Think of it not so much as the self vanishing, but more that container, that sense of you actually expanding, becoming much broader, much vaster, much less limited. Right? So it can becoming a much broader, expansive quality. That's actually easier to surrender and relax into than kind of feeling like you're going to pop like a soap bubble and just completely no longer exist. And perhaps this is what the Buddhist, one of the things he's pointing toward, is if you're like the earth has this quality of vastness. It's unaffected by this small action of one person. It can't get rid of the dirt completely. It can get rid of a little bit of it, but it just is so vast. So it's asking us to shift from this kind of narrow perspective into a much vaster perspective. Now, when you start to get a taste of that, and this is something that you may have already had some experiences of it. Some of you may have some very clear, obvious experiences of this. But it's almost a sneaky way we start to do it just through our mindfulness practice. Because we ask you to sit and just simply connect with this body breathing. Connect with sounds are arising without adding things to it. Relaxing the normal evaluative process, the normal sense of comparing, even the sense of labeling. Sort of like you're starting to get closer and closer to the direct experience. In other words, you're kind of taking out this interpretation factor. You know, you don't lose that. You know, still know how to do that. You know, when it's raining, you put on a raincoat. But it's really how that creates a level of separation with this experience. When you start to relax that, when that starts to fall away, there's no longer that sense of kind of separation that's the present. And you start to notice that in meditation. As I was kind of lost my, I was in Minnesota yesterday, so I'm a little jet lagged. In meditation, when we simply connect with the experience, just how it is, we're actually loosening that sense of self. Have you ever noticed that when you're meditating, your body becomes less defined? Like the sense of your body is not so clear? As if you're looking at the mirror, you see your body, and you probably see, okay, I like that part, I don't like this part, wish this part was taller or shorter or whatever it might be. But when you close your eyes and actually go into the felt sense of the body, it's a lot less amorphous, it's more amorphous, it's less defined. That sense of you is less established in that. Or you might notice when you're meditating and you really connect with the moment, there's a quieting, there's a sense of softening of that sense of self. So it starts to come in from the very beginning. And when that sense of self falls away, sometimes you can have this, it's often this sense that there's something that's always been there is no longer there. You're kind of looking for it, but it doesn't make sense. It's like it's no longer hooking up, like a gear is missing. That perspective of you having this experience. But instead of being a sense of panic or a sense of fear, it's actually a sense of ease, a sense of softening, of relief. One person described it as like taking off shoes which have been too tight. It's like, okay, finally the feet can breathe. There's this loosening of this constraint that we've lived with. And there's often this experience of deep connection, this deep relationship to everything. And yet there's also nothing you can claim as you, because it just doesn't make sense. This is not who, this is not of me. And yet there's still something which is present, right? So we're getting a little deep in here. But in this sutta, when I read this, this is what the Buddha's pointing toward. If you want to understand this kind of riddle, how do you be a human being with emotions and reactions and boundaries and all these conditioning and yet not act from that? How do you not deny it and repress it? How do you not adopt a kind of a pretend sense of kindness? It's through really examining that sense of you, that sense of self. And this sutta is beautiful in this way, that instead of going through this kind of wisdom gate he often goes through in the suttas, he's like, just be like the earth. Be like that vastness. So there's other aspects of this sutta, the other analogies he uses, is to be like the air. Where's that one? Yeah, basically be like the air, right? So if you came along and tried to paint the air, so he's using like a brush, but we can imagine taking spray paint, trying to spray paint something in the air, it's just going to be blown away. It's not going to stick. It's not going to affect the air in any way. So then be like the air with not only your metta, but also that perspective where the metta comes from. Be that quality of expansiveness. Right, so this is a challenging teaching. It's a deep teaching, but yet it's also maybe just can be very helpful, because so often we're trying to solve ourselves, trying to solve our problems, but we're kind of in a closed loop. Okay, I've got to be kind. I've got to be compassionate, right? And the Buddha's saying maybe try being like nature, be this quality of spaciousness. Another analogy he uses is be like the river Ganges, this vast river flowing down, and someone took a torch and tried to light it on fire. They're going to be pretty disappointed. It's going to just be quenched by it. And the final analogy, he talks about a bag, I think a type of leather bag that's so soft and so pliable, it just connects and holds things without any distortion. Trying to make that brittle and tight, you'd be disappointed. So for me, this is what this sutta points to as an expression of metta, right? So metta can be expressed in so many different ways. Okay, may you be safe and protected. The intentional phrases, the quality of wordless emanating of metta. And in this sutta, talking about coming from a deeper place, this place of vastness, expanding that quality, that sense of who you are, a sense of self. And we can become attached to that. We become attached to being that vastness. Okay, I'm this big mind. I'm no longer this narrow mind, but I'm this big mind. And this is why it's so slippery, this Dharma practice, this spiritual practice. And it also requires a lot of deep honesty. Because this process of identification and spiritual bypassing is something we have to keep watching. Whether we're denying something and trying to jump over it, or becoming identified with this way of seeing something. That's what I am. And you start to know that because you start to look down on someone who you don't feel doesn't have that. It's like, oh, if only you had experienced the mind like the earth, then you would be happy, right? Try doing that with your in-laws at Thanksgiving and see how well that goes. And it's a slippery process because we're trying to reform, trying to claim ownership. Right? Because the sense of self, there's this strong hunger to reform. The Buddha called it tanha. It made a whole, the Four Noble Truths, one whole truth is focused on that, how we try to reform ourselves. It's interesting, if you look at the suttas, when the Buddha awakened, you know, he was, it was kind of this big confrontation with Mara, with the goddess, the mythological god, archetypal god of delusion, of confusion, right? Tried to trick the Buddha again and again, all these different ways. And the Buddha actually just let that kind of slide past and just kept reconnecting to the earth, connecting to his presence. And then he finally saw the nature of things in a very deep way. But the suttas, I was so surprised to read that Mara kept showing up, you know, and try to trick the Buddha, try to confuse the Buddha again. And this is part of this identification of what happens. We try to identify with this. There's a sutta where early on, I think it's early on in the Buddha's, you know, career of teaching, that he was trying to teach to a lot of people, you know, maybe just trying to reach people. And this one other spiritual teacher was kind of, got in this kind of competition of spiritual powers. And the Buddha would do something supernatural, and the other guy would say, "Oh, that's pretty good, but you're not as good as me." And then the Buddha would do something even more. And then it just kind of kept going and going. And finally, you know, the Buddha realized that this is not going to work, to let that go. But perhaps in that sutta, he was showing this identification, trying to claim ownership, and this movement away from that ownership to actually come back into the earth. I think it's so helpful to come back to these metaphors. How does the earth, does it care if you're the president of the United States? Does it care if you're, you know, whatever is an opposite side of that? The earth just holds you completely the same way. It keeps holds, there's a way that it teaches you, how nature teaches you that emptiness. And how can the earth claim ownership of itself? So this one way to frame all this is around spiritual bypassing. Okay, that first woman trying to pretend like she was more holy, more spiritual than she really was, right? So then the Buddha gave these examples of how to bring an understanding of emptiness, of that space, expanding that sense of you. I want to also mention another more subtle form of spiritual bypassing that can arise. And that's when, because when we start to have tastes of that transcendence, it can be very beautiful to feel this personal pain fall away. Because, okay, something I've taken is a linchpin. Okay, that sense of me who's having this pain, that I finally realize that sense of me doesn't exist, the pain kind of vanishes, falls away. Right? The slippery part is we can start to find pain come up and we kind of not feel it by jumping over it, doing a spiritual bypass, going around that pain. And it's tricky because I think for many of us, that's what our pain really needs, is to be transcended. But how we do it is so important, not through denial, not through repression, but actually going through into it, into deeply into it. So how do we know if we're spiritual bypassing is maybe the core of the question. I think one of the biggest aspects is paying attention to the impact of our actions. Okay, the impact of our actions. Not, you know, the intention of our actions is one thing, but we can have intentions which feel like they're good, but the actions themselves maybe not so good, how people receive that. So if you start to get feedback from people, okay, you're causing some harm here, and we just kind of blow that off or go into this, okay, the earth doesn't really care if you're upset at me. That's kind of a blunt way of saying it. So I can imagine doing that to my wife. That would not go over very well. But that's a little bit of what happens. If we kind of go into this bigger sense of us, bigger mind, and that seems like those things just don't matter. So we have to be honest and willing to come and listen to that feedback, to actually go back into this sense of form. Because we can become attached to these big, big states of mind. You know, if you look at spiritual teachers who cause harm through misuse of power, of boundary violations, sexual violations, money violations, all these things. And every tradition has it. Every tradition has it, we all have our teachers who do that, including this tradition. And it's often this is like this, this is this distortion, this spiritual bypassing, that it's all empty. Everything is so vast, so it doesn't, you know, your hurt doesn't really matter. Right? And that is so destructive. It causes so much pain. And so we learn that, you know, individually as practitioners, we learn that as a community, to really listen to the harm that comes. How can we be with it? And also, in another checkpoint is, how fully have I felt this pain, this personal pain? How deeply have I felt it? Have I felt it to the point where I actually see how it changes and distorts the way I see the world? Right? So those of you who have done psychological work, I mean, that's a lot of the terrain, is learning to see how maybe archaically we developed strategies, belief systems that make us see the world in a certain way. You know, there's ways we relate to our emotions, our anger, our, all these different qualities. You throw in trauma, throw in abuse. All these things cause a lot of things we have to learn to unpack. Right? So if we're able to feel it in a deep way and open to it in a deep way, have a sense of centeredness in the midst of that, then we can start to play with that transcendence. We can start to release that. So I know often when I talk about spiritual bypassing, people kind of freak out and say, I think I'm spiritual bypassing things. But it feels very different. Because you have to go really, willingness to go into things deeply, to open to them deeply, to the point where they actually let go of you. Right? So probably most people who are listening were probably a little attached to our pain. Because who would we be if we weren't having this pain, if we weren't defined by that? If we weren't oriented around that. Right? So just it's an interesting ground to play with. You know, how can we find that way through it? I think in Zen they talk about the way to nirvana, to awakening, is through samsara, is through our suffering. So opening to the depth of this personal pain, instead of doing this sleight of hand of jumping over it. And you start to know that own integrity starts to show you. Because if you're really kind of doing a spiritual bypass, there's a way that you're kind of avoiding something. You're not quite feeling it. You're kind of turning away from it. And then remember that first story that I read. Life's going to show it. You're going to get kind of over the top, upset at times, because that suppression isn't going to last. So how do we do this? And this is one of the benefits of being in relationship and in community with our friends, with our partners, is that they show us when we start to have that friction, right? Strangers show us, right? So how can we be full-hearted people? How can we leave from a place of compassion and yet also honoring our own human experience? You know, this quality of vastness of the earth can be a beautiful part of that. We also have to be willing to connect with the depth of our pain. And then metta is there for that depth too. Metta transforms into the compassion. Let me feel this pain of this heart. Let me feel the pain in another person. All right, so let's just sit quietly for a couple moments, letting those words settle. Thank you for your kind attention. So in a second here, we'll have a chance to see if there's any questions. I know I went into some deep waters, and hopefully we can use those questions to help clarify. Or if there's anything you'd like to ask about practice. But first, the homework. So this week, I'm really focusing around this simile of the saw, you know, focusing around the themes that we talked about. So try to pull up the simile of the saw. Just type that in. You can do MN21, Majjhimakaya number 21. Access to Insight is a nice site to use, but you can find that other translations. So, you know, read that and see how it resonates with you. It is a pretty dramatic sutta. Oh, I forgot to mention, The reason it's called the simile of the saw is the Buddha, you know, goes through all these examples. Okay, be like the earth, be like the sky, be like water. You know, people are insulting you. You know, you just expand, actually offer metta back without suppressing it, without denying. And simile of the saw is like, even if, I can just imagine some monks saying, well, what about if someone says this, or what if someone steals my robe or something like that? He says, even if there's bandits who are savagely sawing your limbs from your body, still be offering metta to them. Right? So kind of the high bar there, kind of put all those, and basically it's an invitation, keep practicing. Even if life feels difficult, even try to practice in those. And by doing that, you're going to start to find that there's actually more possible than you thought. And some of the fun parts are when you just spontaneously find yourself acting a different way. It's like, wow, I acted in a kind way, an interconnected way in this difficult situation. And I don't think I would have before. So just notice that. Okay, so notice times when you pretend to be kinder than you really are in order to maintain some type of persona or image. So when you notice, so when I say notice that, I'm literally mean notice it, not judge it, but to actually be aware of that. Actually start to, okay, this is interesting. I have this persona I want to hold more dear than the actual reality of what I'm feeling. And practice metta with instructions from the sutta. See if any of those resonate. How would the earth relate to this? How can I start to tap into this quality of emptiness, of spaciousness, this bigger sense of me? Can it be done without denying your emotions or reactions, yet not acting from them? Right? So this is challenging. But this is, I think, why we practice. This is why we practice. Right, so we have a quick chance for any questions or sharing you might have. So thank you, Nate's got the, for in the, those in the room, if you can raise your hand, he'll bring the mic so he can hear you online. Online, you can just raise your virtual hand and we can call you. Yes, Nate up here.
Hello, my name is Jenna. In this practice, when you're experiencing those emotions in the moment,
yeah,
and you invoke this practice as we practice, if we still have those emotions, mm-hmm. even if we don't react in those moments, how do you express those in a way that doesn't result in repression?
That's the big question. So basically kind of the process that I tend to use is that I try to really use my internal sensations as a litmus test, because sometimes you have emotions that you don't really realize are happening, or someone says something and there's a little tightness and my mind kind of overrides it until later that I was really upset about that. Or sometimes you notice in the moment. So, and I kind of use that as a way of telling how clear I am or unclear I am. Right? So I feel a little reaction. So the first kind of way is to bring attention to it, to bring consciousness to it. Can I actually open to the sensations of the body, open to the beliefs around it, and have some way of slowing down their kind of knee-jerk reaction, right? So then what do you do with it? And that's actually an expression of metta, is this turning toward, to be next to. It's almost built into the mindfulness practice, is this willingness to connect with something is an actual act of metta, especially if we're connecting without ill will, without hatred. So we do that to ourselves. Okay, let me really get to know this experience, right? And then once I do that, then I don't think, you know, Dharma practice is going to solve everything. Sometimes we have to bring other tools to bear. Sometimes we have to establish clear boundaries. Sometimes we have to remove ourselves from the situation. Sometimes we have to advocate. Sometimes we have to get a restraining order. I mean, there's all these different ways that we navigate. But realizing that turning toward is often kind of, compassion is often going to be really needed. Okay, I myself really feel what's here. One of my questions I often listen for when I talk to students is, what are you not allowing about yourself? What are you not allowing about your experience? If you can just learn to allow that, things start to loosen up. Because so often we're kind of like, I shouldn't be feeling this. You know, okay, well, once if it's, you just feel it, and something softens. And then how do you actually act in the world? There's so many different ways that that happens. What I just described, that could be like a few day or few month process, right? For some of the real sticky ones. But as we do it more and more, we start to be able to do it much more quickly. Does that help at all?
Yeah. Very much. Thank you.
Thank you for asking that. All right. Any other questions or sharing?
Thank you. Hey, I'm Ann. I don't know if it's the way that I'm just relating to the metaphor of being like the earth. What that makes me think of is, yes, I think that the earth will carry on no matter what happens, right? So, but to me, that does feel like bypassing, and it feels really different than like acknowledging, like, the pain of the other, the pain that I feel. And I'm just kind of trying to put these things together. Like, yes, I understand like getting big and saying, okay, well, this doesn't matter in the grand scheme of things. But so I think I'm just not relating quite right to the metaphor.
Yeah, it is really a tricky sutta, the way it is like a, it is almost this whole sutta is kind of like a spiritual riddle or a koan. Like, how do we find our way through that? Because the way you articulate it, that is kind of the issue, right? It's so easy to kind of discount and to push away. I actually like, I didn't emphasize this one, but the error one. I actually like that one a little bit more. Because when I'm listening to someone, and let's say they're upset with me or I'm upset with them, if I have this quality of spaciousness around it, it's like I'm allowing things to flow through without being sticky, and yet I can be very intimate with them. I can still be very connected to that experience, if that makes sense. So a lot of it kind of comes down to how personal do I take that? You know, do I really kind of dig in my heels? Like, no, I'm, you know, this is when I feel like I'm right and you're wrong, right? So that's, you know, bringing a little bit of that air quality or the quality of the river or a quality of the earth to help loosen that sense of I'm right and you're wrong kind of quality. Does that make sense a little bit? What's that?
More flow.
More flow, yeah. Yes, and sometimes what's really needed, I like to be very practical, because sometimes what's needed is, okay, maybe I needed to have a more upfront conversation with this person about how I feel. You know, I think if we're going to run through, there's so many strategies that comes to mind, but you know, one is to really take full ownership of your own experience. Okay, I'm feeling mad versus you're making me mad. That's like therapy 101, but it's also a really hard lesson to learn. Okay, this is my experience, and to really hold someone else's experience as valid and connected. Right, so this sutta may not speak so much to that, and that may that approach may be really what's needed. Yeah, what I would tend to say is, I'm gonna say something, and I may change my mind later on about this, but it's almost like it might be a good rule of thumb is to kind of lead with that interpersonal dynamic. First, the emotional health dynamic, really listening deeply, you know, having clear boundaries, leave with that. And the things that which get sticky then start to bring forth this other quality. Does that make sense? So if I have an interaction with someone and I talk to them and there's a sense of really acknowledgement and there's no residue, I'm not really thinking about it anymore, then that's great. But if I feel like, okay, I still kind of ruminate around it, I can't let go, I've said what needs to be said, I think I've explored it, then perhaps this is another approach to bring to it. Yeah, so it's tricky. I completely completely understand, or not know if I completely understand, but I relate to that struggle around it. Yeah. Yeah, it's almost like maybe this is another way to answer it, is kind of maybe 10 or 20% of my awareness is in that bigger perspective, and 80% is in the interpersonal. And that just gives a little bit more spaciousness around it. I'm able to see another side of this, of the perspective, a little bit more easily when I bring that forth. Yeah, because I'm trying to think when the last time I was 100% in the earth, you know, with a conflict. But there's a relationship to it. There's a way it informs the way I navigate that. Okay. Any other questions? Anyone online or back in the room?
So, in my experience, so when I find myself in a reactive position, in a conflict, one of the things that's great that I feel like the practice has given to me is I often will catch the other person's reaction in an earlier or subtler way. Mm. And that kind of gives me, I feel like I can open a little bit from there. It's like, oh, I'm pushing this person away. I'm making them uncomfortable. Mm. And it's like, okay, I can use that as kind of a trigger point, say, oh, I'm really contracted right now, mm. which is wonderful. And that's great. It's like, and then there are other times where it's like, oh, I'm starting to feel contracted and I can loosen from there. But how do you, I find myself feeling a little bit frustrated at, that I keep finding myself in that position of like, oh, I'm contracted and I'm pushing this person away. Mm. And, yeah. What do you think? Where's a good place to start backing that back away, trying to find a little bit more perhaps connection in the body or something so that you back away from getting into those conflicts in the first mm-hmm. place where you see a person moving away and it's like, oh, now I'm already in it. The damage has already been done.
Does it feel like it's repetitive patterns? You've gone down that route a few times?
Yeah, I think we all have, you know, where we find ourselves in that position of a conflict that is not where we want it to be.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's painful. It hurts to be in that position where you know that somebody is suffering because of your reactivity. And there's a desire to move back from it and identify it before it gets to that point.
Yes, and that very intention is an intention of metta, right? It's an intention of well-wishing, of kindness, of trying to cause less harm. So just to acknowledge that intention. So for myself, what I've found is often things happen very quickly, right? There's a lot of reactions, a lot of kind of pinballs are popping around in just almost a split second. And so you're catching something, but there's probably stuff that happened before that that kind of happened too quickly to be able to perceive it. So there's that. Basically, what I'm saying is it's turning to that quality of both metta, compassion, and also mindfulness and investigation to really unpack that a little bit more clearly, right? So part of it is you're kind of reflecting what you're feeling. If it's someone that you're in relationship with or connected to, what's been really helpful for me, because I had a pattern, I think I've shared this a few times. When my family and I would go on a vacation, I would tend to get kind of really tight around it. Like I wanted to leave on time. And I would get kind of harsh in my language and there would be, you know, they would have their reactions. And I would see that and I was, okay, I want to do differently. But I kept doing it again and again, right? So I'm already gone too far. And then finally, I ask them to kind of share their experience of me when I'm being harsh, when I'm being in that place. And I was able to ask in a way they were able to actually tell me what that was like. So that sharing of that's listening to the feedback from those who are impacted gave me a different level of urgency to pay attention to it. Because as they said it, I would reflect, okay, let me, what's it like from my side of it? What's my, the way I'm holding the world? What's my agenda? How come I discount the relationship to this imaginary agenda? Like, we got to hurry up to be so we can have fun together. You know, it's like it doesn't make any sense after a while. So part of it is kind of looking at it from a more full, deep way. And so sitting with it, you know, opening to it, reflecting on those experiences. Okay, what's going on? How does it serve me is a good question too. What's the unconscious way that it serves you? Because if it didn't serve you at all, you wouldn't do it, right? We don't usually go around kicking bricks because, you know, once we do it once, we don't really need to keep doing it. We kind of avoid that. So as part of it is, you know, it's painful, but you're also not noticing how it serves you. And so these are really complex patterns, right? There's lots of dynamics, and the other people have their own dynamics too. So it's, you know, depending on the relationship, you know, whether it's an acquaintance or someone you live with, you can have more in-depth unpacking of that. But it really depends upon that willingness to be turned toward, to be connected to see it in an unflinchingly honest way. And that's one thing about mindfulness, is that when we see it very clearly, that's what transforms us. You know, versus, okay, I want to get rid of this pattern. Often that kind of tightens up the pattern. But if I really, let me just not do anything with it other than deeply know it. Yeah. So there's a few.
Yeah. Thanks. That brings some clarity.
A few weeks or months of work for you there. All right, Gary, go ahead, and then we can go to Karen.
What you were just describing is similar to what I wanted to share. Last week, a close relative of mine in a text asked me to do something, and it felt unusual to me for him to ask me to do what he was asking me. And I told him that. I responded that in my text, and then he wanted to talk to me right away, which I appreciated. But I thought I needed some more time to figure out what was going on with me. And today we finally connected, and I still wasn't quite sure why I was in a projection of some kind. But I asked him, would you help me understand your thinking behind your ask? And he did. And I could feel myself relax because it was totally reasonable for him to ask what he was asking for. So there's an example of realizing it was my fault, not my fault, but I had some work to do.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that. It's like we do this all the time. We make put a projection upon another person about their actions, what the motivation is. And if we have the luxury of being able to actually talk to them, actually, like, that's a great phrase. Let me understand your thinking around it. That's a real life way of bringing this sutta to life. It's like, instead of like texting back angrily and saying, no way, there's no way I'm going to do that. Okay, let me sit with it. Let me open to it. Let me stay in a relationship to it, to actually bring that quality of care and connection. And maybe you would have done it and had to say no after hearing their thinking, you know, but you stayed in relationship. And that's probably one way to sum up metta, is being in relationship, is being connected to, being with. And the journey of that is seen through our projections, through our delusions, and all of those different things.
Thank you.
Thank you, Gary. All right, Karen, would you like to go ahead?
I have a question about intention. That word has been, I mean, I could probably tell you what the Webster's Dictionary is on intention, like the definition of intention, but I have a misunderstanding of it when it comes to my practice. Like you said, like turning towards fear or anger, and this metta is to develop a different intention towards those emotions.
Yeah.
And then you made a comment of, is, and I'm asking the question, like, what would it feel like not to have anger or be angry? Misquoting you, I'm sure, but what would it feel like? Is that the intention I'm supposed to set? Or when you wake up, like, set the intention of the day, or when you sit, what's your intention? And, you know, I feel very tasky. My intention on Saturday is to get the lawn mowed, but, you know, that's a task. So how does that, I want to say usual word of intention being then with your practice around emotion or setting your intention to be present with anger, like, but also be open and vast, almost seems like a contradiction, you know, like one very direct and the other one's very open, and you know, and then the question of what would it feel like to be without anger, being angry.
Yeah.
I'm confused with that.
Sure. Yeah, that's a great question. Yeah, because intention is a word we use in spirituality in different ways. Like, I'm going to set a positive intention or intention to, you know, meditate every day or whatever it might be. It's like a goal is in some ways we use the word intention. I was using it more the way it's used in the Eightfold Noble Path. Mm-hmm. And that is, so the first one is view, wise view. And the second one is wise intention, or sometimes called wise aim. Okay, so it's like an aim precedes our actions. Right, so often this is kind of an unconscious quality that we don't really realize what view we're coming from. So view is kind of this sense of, maybe one, there's many ways we can describe it. One is to say separation versus connection. So if I have this view of it's basically, we could say the basic assumptions or the basic perspective I'm taking. If I see something as separate, my intention is going to flow from that view. Okay, something separate from me, I'm going to be protective, I'm going to push away, I'm going to be angry or scared, all those things. From that intentionality, from the aiming of my deeper beliefs or perspective, then my actions flow from that. So it's actually a much more kind of subtle quality. And to try to make it just more of a shorthand, like I'll give an example. My wife and daughter and I were coming back from Irish dance competition, and we had parked our car in a, we parked it someplace in a valet service. And when I called to get the car, they said, well, you got to talk to the manager because they actually crashed our car, you know, coming, trying to take it back. But it's interesting to watch what came. I wasn't actually angry. I was like, oh, tell me more about that. You know, and I was connected to that person and realized there was not a good day for them to have that happen. You know, so it was kind of a, for whatever reason, the anger didn't come from that. It was more of a turning to our connection. So for the view that was established in that moment was one of interconnection. From that, my intention, it kind of linked, it's like a link between my view, my perspective, my relationship with experience, and how I act in relationship to that. I can give you lots of other examples where, you know, anger came up. So it's kind of like with Gary's example, it's like coming toward that sense of, let me hear your side. Let me understand you more fully. You know, let me not go down quickly that path of anger.
But if you're doing it with yourself, where I can see of another person, you're misunderstanding the other person because they're not inside your head. You know, it's outside of.
Yeah.
Tension is when it's coming from inside your head. I don't know if I'm making myself clear, but.
Sure. Yeah, that's a great part of practice is that there's this inner and outer way we practice. And learning to work with our inner experience, our inner narrative, our inner relationship actually starts to transform the exterior. Mm-hmm. I think that's why we start to find that we do this internal practice, then we find we're acting differently with the people around us. I didn't really make a choice to do that, but it's like I just act differently. There's more patience. There's more connection. And so it's trickier because it's so close. And this is why I think our inner narrative, the way our self-talk is so important to start to bring into our practice also. And it's...
Keep that vastness, that openness. I don't know, I guess I'm hitting some things and I don't know how to keep that openness towards what arises. And where my intention is to be then. What's my intention then?
Just a second here. Yeah, so your intention is, you know, like similar to Adam's question, is just to see, okay, what's the landscape that's here? And try to hold the thoughts a little bit more lightly. Mm-hmm. Don't get so convinced by them. Like I noticed in my practice, when I started to practice, I became more aware of my inner narrative. I would make a mistake and say, oh, you're such an, my inner narrative would go like, I'm such an idiot. I'm always clumsy in this way. You know, I just have this, I just go on and on and on, paragraphs of paragraphs. After I started to practice, I would feel that load up and start, oh, I'm such an idiot. And then that's where the stillness would come in. That's where the vastness in would come in. It would just kind of dissolve. I would see it and not be so identified with it. That's another way to just talk about this whole vastness stuff. It'd just be less identified. And then it started to become shorter and shorter. Oh, I'm such, and then intention would, the sense of intentionality of kindness would come forth. And the sense of me being less defined by my thoughts of myself came forth. Yeah.
And even as you see it, try not to then go into the next one of an intention to fix it.
Yes. Yeah. Fixing it is, I mean, there's a place for that, but fixing it tends to kind of maintain the cycle. So that's one of the hard things is, can I be with it without doing anything with it?
Mm-hmm.
And just trust the seeing it more fully and deeply.
Thank you.
It does work.
Thank you.
Thank you, Karen. Thanks for hanging in there. Okay, good. Gary got taken care of. All right, anyone else? Yeah, go ahead.
I just had a thought comment that developed listening to the last few comments and what you had presented on the difficulty in grasping this concept, and the word significance came into my mind. You know, evaluating the significance of whatever's happening in context of this vastness. I don't know if that helps resonate with anyone, but I thought I would share. Thank you.
Yeah, I think that's that sense of discernment, you know, how significant is this? And it does change too, right? It's like sometimes things which seem so significant at one point become less significant. And sometimes you realize, oh, I've been kind of discounting that. I need to bring that more to the forefront. Yeah, it's such interesting terrain that we explore here. All right, so next week we'll have a chance to do some inner kind of small group dialogue around this. And I'll do a short recap of this talk. Those are such important weeks because it allows you to integrate what you're learning. You know, take this back home, take it into your relationships. How does this show up? All right, so thank you for your questions. It really helps flesh out the practice, and thanks for all the volunteers. All right, thank you so much. All right, be well, and I'll see you next time, whenever that might be.